Imagine spending months writing, 12,000 lines of beautiful code. You've built this polished, state-of-the-art software product.
Right, something you're incredibly proud of.
Exactly. The design is gorgeous, the features are just cutting edge, and then you realize your users absolutely hate it.
Ouch. Yeah, that is a nightmare.
And they hate it simply because of where it lives. So today, we are taking a deep dive into the brutal reality of moving an application from your web browser to your phone's home screen.
It's a journey a lot of developers have to make, whether they want to or not.
Yeah, and we're going to see why copy-pasting your code is, frankly, the biggest myth in software. We're using a real developer's highly detailed project logs to do this.
It is a fascinating case study because it really exposes a massive blind spot for a lot of builders out there.
How so?
Well, you often build for the platform you personally know how to code for. You don't necessarily build for the platform where your users actually spend their time.
That makes total sense. And if you ever wondered how much work actually goes into building those apps sitting on your phone right now, this deep dive is definitely going to change how you look at them.
Oh, absolutely.
So our source material follows the creator of an application called Elon. Basically, this is an AI photo generation tool.
Right. And it's important to understand the target audience here. They are targeting women between 18 and 35 who want, effortless, highly stylized photos for social media.
Effortless being the key word there. So the developer originally built this as a highly polished web application, right?
Yeah, they used a framework called Next.js, which is basically an incredibly powerful toolkit for building React websites. I mean, they spent months on this thing.
And then we get the inciting incident. The developer shows this beautiful web app to a friend. They are fully expecting them to be blown away by it.
Yes, of course you are. You just spent months on it.
Right. But the friend takes one look and immediately asks, "Can I try it on my phone?"
The dreaded question for a web developer. Seriously. So the developer says, sure, just open up your mobile web browser like Safari or Chrome and type in the link.
And let me guess, the friend wasn't thrilled.
Not at all. The friend just looks at them and says, okay, I'll try it later.
And she never did.
Never did.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes perfect sense why she didn't. For this specific demographic, the entire workflow of taking a photo, editing it, and posting it to a platform like WeChat Moments, that all happens entirely inside the native phone environment.
Right, you're not tabbing out to Safari to do that.
Exactly. A web browser, no matter how beautifully designed the website is inside of it, it just feels like a massive, clunky detour.
Okay, but I have to push back here for a second. My first instinct when reading this was, well, why build a whole new native mobile app at all?
Because it sounds like a lot of extra work.
It does. I mean, I pull up websites on my phone to upload files or edit things all the time. Why not just use a progressive web app, a PWA?
Yeah, where you just tap add to home screen and it gives you a little icon. Exactly. It pretends to be a real app. Why wasn't that the solution?
It is the most logical first question, and honestly, it's exactly what the developer considered first. PWAs promise the best of both worlds.
Because you write the web code once and users just save it.
Right. But here's the catch, and it's why PWAs fail completely for Elon. They are terrible when you need deep hardware access.
Oh, because the phone's operating system doesn't trust a website the way it trusts a real app from the App Store.
Partially security, yes. But on iOS specifically, it is also a deliberate business choice by Apple.
Interesting.
Apple intentionally limits the capabilities of PWAs to push developers toward the official App Store. So a PWA's access to your local photos is heavily sandboxed.
Meaning you can't just easily grab a photo or save one.
Exactly. There is no reliable way to just tap a button and seamlessly save a generated AI image to your camera roll without these weird, clunky pop-ups.
Oh, that ruins the effortless vibe immediately.
It really does. Plus, push notifications are heavily throttled. And
Wow.
that native share sheet you use all the time, where you click share and your most recent messages slide up.
Oh, yeah, I use that constantly.
Right. Well, that deep system integration basically doesn't exist for a PWA.
Wow. So if your core loop relies on manipulating the user's camera roll and sharing to WeChat, a PWA fundamentally breaks your product.
It completely breaks the illusion of it being a native tool.
That means the developer had to make a massive stack decision. They have this Next.js web app written in TypeScript, which is, essentially a stricter, more organized version of JavaScript.
Yeah, and they desperately need to get it onto a phone natively.
So what were the options? Because they are a solo developer, right? They need to move fast.
Right. They essentially had three options. Option one was Flutter. This is a very popular cross-platform framework created by Google.
I've heard of Flutter. It's supposed to be really fast.
It has incredible performance. The problem is you have to write it in a programming language called Dart.
Oh no, which means throwing away all that TypeScript code they already wrote.
Exactly. Zero code reuse. It's not a port at that point. It's a total rewrite from scratch.
Okay, so option one is out. What was option two?
Option two is going fully native, writing in Swift for Apple devices and Kotlin for Android devices.
Which gives you the absolute best performance and the deepest system integration.
Right. It does. But for a solo developer, that sounds like a total nightmare.
Yeah, because you're now maintaining three separate code bases. You've got web, iOS, and Android.
Exactly. Every time you add a single button, you have to write it three times. It is a guaranteed recipe for burnout.
I would quit on week two. So what was option three?
Option three, which was the winner, was React Native using a tool chain called Expo.
Okay, so how does that solve the problem?
React Native allows you to build real native mobile apps using the exact same JavaScript and React architecture the developer already used for the web app.
Oh, nice. So you keep the same programming language, TypeScript, you keep the same mental model.
Exactly. Plus, Expo's latest software development kit, SDK 55, finally has robust, built-in tools for handling the phone's file system and image libraries.
Okay, so the developer makes a bet. They say, I can keep all my underlying business logic from the web, and I'll just rewrite the visual interface for the phone.
That was the hope, yeah.
But let's look at the developer's beautifully brutal code reuse scorecard. Because this is where the industry marketing meets reality, doesn't it?
Oh, man, the honesty in the scorecard is so refreshing.
Because people usually lie about this.
All the time. In software engineering circles, you constantly hear teams boast about achieving, like, 90% code reuse when they switch to React Native.
90% seems suspiciously high.
Because it is. This developer warns that those numbers are usually wildly exaggerated. Teams will count thousands of lines of copy-pasted text definitions and claim they reused the code, completely masking the actual labor involved.
Okay, so let's get into the real numbers. Let's start with what actually hit that mythical 100% reuse mark. What transferred perfectly?
The prompt construction logic and the data for the muse cards.
The muse cards are those inspiration styles users tap on.
Exactly. That transferred completely. And the reason why is crucial. All of that logic lives on the back-end server.
Oh. I see.
The mobile app itself doesn't do any of the heavy AI prompt writing. It just sends a card ID to the server, and the server does the heavy lifting. So the phone gets all that complexity completely for free.
That makes total sense. Next, the logs show about 95% reuse on their API contracts.
Right, which are the rules dictating how the app talks to the server. You know, the field names, the data structures.
But why wasn't it a full 100%? The source mentions tweaking something called immutability rules. What does that actually mean in plain English?
Think of immutability as a strict rule about not changing data behind the scenes.
Okay, how so?
Well, on a web browser, if you forcefully change a list of uploaded photos in your code, the browser is usually forgiving enough to just figure it out and update the screen.
Browsers are pretty flexible like that.
Yeah, but mobile environments are highly constrained regarding memory. React Native requires strict immutability. Meaning you can't just alter an existing piece of data.
Yes, you have to make a copy.
Exactly. You have to create a brand new copy of it with the changes. If you break this rule, the mobile interface simply won't refresh.
Oh, wow. So the user is just left staring at a frozen screen.
Basically, yeah. So the developer had to spend time tightening all those data rules just to keep the screen updating.
Gotcha. Okay, here is where my favorite part of the scorecard comes in. The Zustand store patterns. They rated this at about 85% transferability.
Right. Zustand is the state management library.
It's essentially the app's short-term memory.
Right.
Remembering what step of the process you're on or what photo you just selected.
Yes, exactly. And the overarching architecture of that memory transferred, even if the exact lines of code had to change.
Why did the code have to change if the memory is the same?
Because the implementation shifted slightly. The actual flow of uploading a photo and then waiting for an AI generation is mechanically different on a phone compared to a desktop browser.
You know, it makes me think of moving to a new city.
How do you mean?
Well, you can bring your daily routine, you can bring your personal budget, that's your underlying logic, and your memory, but you can't bring your old living room setup.
Because the floor plan is different.
Exactly. You have to buy entirely new furniture to fit the physical layout of the new house. And the furniture in this case is the user interface.
That analogy hits the nail on the head, and it perfectly explains the partial transfers we see next.
Right, because only about 40% of the UI components transferred.
Because the furniture just doesn't fit the new room.
Exactly. On the web, you build the skeleton of the site using HTML tags, right? Like divs or spans.
Yeah, standard web building blocks.
But React Native doesn't understand HTML at all. It uses its own mobile-specific building blocks, like view or text.
Right, you cannot share a single line of that visual skeleton. What transfers is the conceptual structure.
So the app knows it needs a couch. It just has to buy a new one.
Exactly. You still have a component called part picker or photo count slider. The app knows it needs those pieces, but the actual code rendering them onto the glass of the phone is completely rewritten.
Wow. And then we get to the zeros, the stuff that flat out failed the transfer.
Yeah, the real pain points.
Authentication was 0%. And this is a great example of the hidden friction between web and mobile. I think most people assume locking in is just logging in.
It seems like it should be universal, right?
Yeah. Why is it so vastly different?
It comes down to how browsers automatically handle security versus how mobile apps have to do it completely manually.
Okay, break that down for me.
So on the web, Elon uses something called HTT-only cookies. This is a highly secure web standard where the server slips a digital ID card into your browser. And your browser automatically shows that ID card to the server every single time you click a new page. The JavaScript code can't even see the ID card, which prevents hackers from stealing it.
That sounds incredibly secure and easy. But a mobile app isn't a web browser.
Exactly. React Native cannot handle those cookies in that automated, invisible way.
So what happens if you try?
If you try to use the web login code on the phone, the phone essentially just drops the ID card on the floor.
Oh, no. So nobody can log in.
Right. So the developer had to adapt. The mobile app has to manually capture the user's secure token and explicitly attach it as a header to every single network request it sends.
That sounds tedious.
It is. It sounds like a minor detail. But if you don't know the underlying mechanics of how those tokens travel, your app simply will not let a single user log in.
So the developer wrestles with the UI. They rewrite the login. It's tedious, but it's expected. But here is where we hit the most fascinating roadblock in this entire source material.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, because there was one invisible technical wall that almost derailed the whole mobile project. The core feature of getting the generated photos back to the user was fundamentally broken.
The streaming crisis.
Yes. Let's lay out the mechanics of this. Elan doesn't just make you stare at a loading spinner for 2 minutes and then pop out a finished photo.
Right, that would be a terrible user experience.
It generates them incrementally. The server sends data events down the pipe as each individual photo finishes processing.
And on the web, this streaming behavior is handled effortlessly by a technology called server sent events, or SSE.
SSE is brilliant, honestly.
Yes, it really is. Instead of the phone constantly nagging the server every 2 seconds asking, "Are you done yet?" the server just keeps a single open connection.
It pushes updates down the pipe in real time. Generation started, photo one completed, photo two completed.
Right, and it works flawlessly on a Chrome or Safari web browser.
But when the developer tried to use the exact same code on React Native for the iPhone, the underlying code that handles that incoming stream of data, something called the readable stream, was returning as null.
It literally did not exist.
I have to ask, why would a modern, widely used framework like React Native just be missing something so critical?
It exposes the hidden plumbing of these frameworks. React Native relies on a JavaScript engine to run your code, right?
Right.
On Android, it uses an engine that supports modern streaming. But on iOS, it relies on Apple's JavaScript Core engine.
Okay.
And at the time of this build, the specific implementation of fetch, which is the command used to grab data from the internet, it simply did not support streaming response bodies in that environment.
Wait, so the engine itself was just broken?
Basically, yes. It's a deeply buried, known limitation that has frustrated the developer community for years.
Imagine hitting that wall. The UI is built, the login works, but the AI photos literally cannot stream to the phone because the engine itself is crippled.
It's a developer's worst nightmare.
So the developer tried some modern library fixes first, didn't they?
Yeah, they tried a popular library called React Native, say, but they hit a protocol wall. That library only supports GET to you requests.
Meaning what exactly?
Think of a DIT request like asking a waiter for a menu. It's a very simple request for information. But Elan's API requires a post request.
Which is more complicated.
Yeah, it's like handing the chef a highly complex recipe and asking them to cook it. The app has to send massive payloads of data, the image style, the prompt instructions to the server.
Ah, I see.
Because the library couldn't handle POST requests, using it would have meant completely rewriting the entire backend AI server just to accommodate the phone.
Which totally defeats the purpose of trying to share the backend in the first place.
Exactly.
So how do you solve a modern framework failing you?
Yeah.
You dig into the graveyard of web technology.
You really do.
The developer had to implement a hack using XML HTTP request, or XHR.
This is ancient technology.
Right. It's the technology that originally made dynamic web pages possible, like 20 years ago.
Mm.
Hold on. If XHR is so old, why did it work when the shiny new tools failed?
It comes down to a very specific mechanical behavior of XHR. It has a built-in event called onProgress.
Okay, what does that do?
Even though it isn't a modern stream, as the server pushes those incremental photo updates down the pipe, XHR fires this progress event. It progressively gathers the raw text of the response as it arrives, chunk by chunk.
So it's basically holding a bucket under a leaky pipe and catching the text as it drips out.
Yes, exactly. But catching the text isn't enough, right? You have to know when a full message has actually arrived in the bucket.
Right.
So the developer built a custom parser. In the SSE protocol, a double new line, literally just hitting enter twice in the code, is the universal signal that a complete message is finished.
Okay, so they look for the double new line.
Right. The custom parser constantly checks the bucket of text, splits at the exact moment it sees those double new lines, extracts the JSON data for the photo, and then triggers the UI update. It perfectly mimics modern streaming.
That is phenomenally clever. It requires zero third-party native modules. It works on both iOS and Android. It's just a brilliantly pragmatic solution.
It is the ultimate lesson in engineering, honestly. Sometimes the most robust solution isn't the newest, shiniest library.
Right.
It is understanding the fundamental protocols of the internet well enough to build your own bridge when the framework collapses under you.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Okay, so the streaming bridge is built. The AI photos are finally flowing to the phone.
Yes.
But getting the data there is only half the battle, isn't it? Once it's there, the user actually has to interact with it, which exposes a massive blind spot for web developers moving to mobile.
Mice versus thumbs.
Yes. The physical constraints of mobile design are completely unforgiving.
They really are. On a web app, your user has a mouse or a trackpad. A mouse pointer is a single, incredibly precise pixel. You can have a tiny button with minimal padding, and the user will click it effortlessly.
It's so true. If you are listening to this on your smartphone right now, look at the play or pause button on your podcast player. Look at the space around it.
Yeah, notice how big it is.
The reason it's exactly the size that it is,
yep,
is because of a very specific mathematical rule that the web just doesn't enforce.
Apple's Human Interface Guidelines. They're HIG.
What is the HIG mandate?
They explicitly mandate that any interactive element needs a minimum touched target area of 44 by 44 pixels.
Oh, wow.
The developer realized their web component only had about 28 pixels of tap area. They were perfectly fine for a mouse, but a human thumb would constantly miss them or accidentally hit the button next to them.
That is so frustrating as a user. So they had to go in and manually inflate the hit boxes of every single button, style, pill, and toggle in the entire application.
Yes, one by one.
And it's not just the buttons themselves, it's where they sit on the physical device.
The safe area insets.
Right.
A computer monitor is a perfect rectangle, but an iPhone has the camera notch at the top and that persistent swipe up home indicator bar at the bottom.
Oh, I hate that swipe bar sometimes.
Right. If you don't calculate your padding mathematically to avoid those physical hardware features, your beautiful Save to Album button ends up physically trapped underneath the swipe bar.
And the user literally cannot tap it.
Exactly. The physical hardware literally dictates your layout math.
But amidst all this tedious UI resizing, the developer noted one incredible bright spot. The dark mode surprise.
This was really interesting.
Usually implementing dark mode is a nightmare of hunting down rogue white pixels that blind the user at 2 a.m.
Yeah, it's awful.
But the source material says it only took 2 hours to get dark mode working perfectly on the mobile app compared to a massive headache on the web. Why the difference?
It comes down to how styling architecture is handled. On the web app, they used a tool called Tailwind, which relies on utility class CSS.
In plain terms, what does that mean?
It means you often have to explicitly define the colors on every single element. You have to write code that says, make this text black, but if the system is in dark mode, make it white.
And you have to do that hundreds of times.
Hundreds of times. But on the mobile app, via Expo, they used a central lookup table for the theme system.
Okay, so how is that different?
So instead of telling the button what color to be, the button just says, use the primary background color.
Ah, I see.
And the app's central brain decides if that means white or black based on the phone's system settings.
The heavy lifting is completely centralized.
Exactly. The app automatically flips the backgrounds and the text while keeping the brand's champagne gold accent colors perfectly consistent.
That is so much cleaner. So we've walked through the hacks, the roadblocks, the thumb sizing. What does this all mean for the final product?
The numbers are really telling here.
I want to look at those final numbers from the source because they reveal a massive insight. The Next.js web code base is 12,000 lines of code. The mobile code base, only 4,200 lines.
The mobile app is roughly 35% the size of the web app.
That's a huge difference.
That number tells the real story of this entire architectural journey. The mobile app is not a heavy, complex piece of machinery. It is a thin client.
A thin client? Mm. Expand on why that matters so much.
It means the mobile application is essentially just a very elegant pane of glass.
Okay.
All the actual intelligence taking the user's choices, constructing the massive AI prompts, communicating with the Gemini AI models, running mathematical checks for facial drift, every single bit of that heavy computing lives on the back-end server.
So the phone is basically just a messenger saying, here's my photo, here's the style I want, wake me up when you're done cooking.
Precisely. And the business value of designing it this way is immense.
How so?
Well, the developer notes in the logs that their next big feature is inspiration image matching.
Oh, where a user can upload a screenshot from the social app like Xiaohongshu, and the AI will automatically analyze it and match it to the closest style template.
Right. And because that visual intelligence lives entirely on the server, the developer can roll out that massive new feature to a web app and the mobile app on the exact same day.
Wow. The phone app doesn't even need a software update from the App Store to suddenly get smarter.
Not at all. That is the ultimate payoff of this architecture. The clients are just dumb windows looking into a very smart room.
That is a fascinating way to look at it.
Yeah.
But looking back at the logs, hindsight is always 20/20.
Always.
What would this developer do differently if they were starting this whole project from scratch today?
They listed three major paradigm shifts. First, they would start mobile first.
Really? But the web app was so much faster for them to build initially. Why abandon that starting line?
Because while the web is easier to build, the mobile app is objectively the superior product for this specific user base.
Oh, because of the integration.
Yes. The local caching makes it faster.
Yeah.
The native sharing to WeChat makes the loop seamless. The direct camera roll access reduces friction.
Makes sense.
If they started today, they would build the Expo mobile app first to capture the core use case and maybe add a web dashboard later for power users.
You build for where the user actually lives.
Exactly.
I also imagine as they were building both, trying to keep the web code and the mobile code in sync must have been a massive headache. Like if you change a variable name on the server, how do you make sure the phone knows about it?
That leads perfectly to their second regret. They would use a shared types package from day one.
What were they doing instead?
In this project, they were manually copying the TypeScript definitions between the web folder and the mobile folder.
Oh, wow. That sounds risky.
It's fine when you only have 6 files.
Right.
But as the app grows, it's a huge liability. If the API suddenly expects a text string, but the mobile app is still sending a number because you forgot to copy the updated file, the app crashes.
Ouch.
Setting up a shared workspace early on ensures both apps are always reading from the exact same rule book.
That is a pro tip right there. And the final piece of hindsight.
They would skip using standard style sheet for the design and use a dedicated UI library called Tomagai.
Why is that better?
While they still dislike the utility class CSS approach we talked about earlier, Tomagai provides built-in theme tokens and responsive layouts that offer much closer parity between web and native styling.
So it's basically a massive time saver.
Exactly. It would have saved them hours of manual layout labor.
Well, so if you are listening to this right now, whether you are a developer mapping out your next big startup, or just someone trying to understand why the apps on your phone behave the way they do, this journey reveals so much about the reality of software.
It really pulls back the curtain.
It does. The idea that you can write once and run anywhere is largely a marketing illusion. You cannot just pick up your coffee shop, drop it in the middle of a desert highway, and expect it to function perfectly.
You have to adapt to the physical and technical environment.
Yes. But if you architect your logic correctly, if you push the heavy intelligence to the server, that illusion can become a hyper-efficient reality.
This raises an important question, actually, one that builds on the thin client concept we discussed.
What's that?
If mobile applications are increasingly becoming just these thin, 4,000-line panes of glass looking into massively complex AI-powered servers, how will this shift change the way we value and design the apps of the future?
That is a great point. Will the app, as we know it, eventually just become a blank screen waiting for server instructions?
It's very possible.
If the intelligence all lives in the cloud, maybe that coffee shop doesn't need to be a fully constructed building at all. Maybe it just needs to be a drive-through window that materializes exactly where the customer already is, capable of perfectly serving whatever they ask for.
Exactly.
Keep that in mind the next time you tap an icon on your home screen.